Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Parkinsonian Syndromes, Improving Diagnostic Sensitivity and Specificity with Dopamine Transporter Imaging, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Robert A. Hauser, MD, MBA, Kenneth Merrick, MD, and Andrew Fagan, MD. Dr. Hauser is a professor of neurology, molecular pharmacology, and physiology, director, Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorder Center, University of South Florida, Tampa, Florida. Dr. Hauser has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from Acadia Pharmaceuticals, Allergan Neuroscience, Chelsea Therapeutics, Genzyme Corporation, Impax Laboratories, Ipsen, Merck Serono, Molecular Biometrics, National Parkinson Foundation, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, Pico Tesla, Shearing Plough Corporation, Schwartz Pharma, Solvay Pharmaceuticals, Teva Neuroscience, the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research, and Xenoport. He served as an advisor or consultant for Adamas Pharmaceuticals, Addex, Bile, Biogenetic, Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Chelsea Therapeutics, GE Healthcare, Impax Laboratories, Ipsen, Lundbeck, Medivation, Merck Serono, EMD Serono, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, Novin Pharmaceuticals, Parkinson Study Group, Quintiles, Santhera Pharmaceuticals, Shearing Plough Corporation, Shire, Solvay Pharmaceuticals, Synosia Therapeutics, Teva Neuroscience, UCB Pharma, and Xenoport. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Allergan Neuroscience, Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, GlaxoSmithKline, Ipsen, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, and Teva Neuroscience. Dr. Hauser has received honoraria for serving as an expert witness. Dr. Hauser has received royalty payments from the University of South Florida. Dr. Hauser does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Hauser does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Merrick is a senior scientist, the Institute for Neurodegenerative Disorders, New Haven, Connecticut. Dr. Merrick has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from Bayer Healthcare Pharmaceuticals, EMD Serono, and GE Healthcare. He served as an advisor or consultant for Bayer Healthcare Pharmaceuticals, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, GE Healthcare, Merck & Company, and Pfizer. He owns stock, stock options, or bonds from Molecular Neuroimaging. Dr. Merrick does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Merrick does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Fagan is an associate professor of neurology and molecular medicine, the Feinstein Institute for Medical Research, Manhasset, New York. Dr. Fagan has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from DWA Foundation, HOSA Foundation, and the National Institutes of Health. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Allergan Neuroscience, Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, and Teva Neuroscience. Dr. Fagan does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Fagan does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to improve understanding of the role of dopamine transporter imaging in the diagnosis of movement disorder symptoms. This activity is supported by GE Healthcare, and the National Parkinson Foundation. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Dr. Robert Hauser, Professor of Neurology, Molecular Pharmacology, and Physiology, and Director of the Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorder Center at the University of South Florida in Tampa. I'd like to welcome you to the spotlight presentation entitled Diagnosing Parkinsonian Syndromes, Improving Sensitivity and Specificity with Dopamine Transporter Imaging. I'm joined today by two colleagues, Dr. Ken Marek, who is president and senior scientist at the Institute for Neurodegenerative Disorders in New Haven, Connecticut, and Dr. Andrew Fagan, who is head of the Laboratory of Experimental Therapeutics for Movement Disorders, the Feinstein Institute for Medical Research, North Shore LIJ Health System. Our learning objectives for today's spotlight are to discuss the role of neuroimaging as an aid in the diagnosis of suspected Parkinsonian syndromes, review patient selection factors that support referral for a neuroimaging study, and explain the clinical relevance of the results of dopamine transporter SPECT scans. A clinical diagnosis of Parkinson's disease can be made with confidence in many patients with the cardinal signs and symptoms, such as rest tremor, bradykinesia, rigidity, and a typical response to dopaminergic medications. However, in some patients, the diagnosis is less clear. New neuroimaging techniques are beginning to provide us with ways to improve our diagnostic accuracy. Dopamine transporter SPECT imaging is now FDA approved and can help differentiate between disorders that are associated with a dopamine neuron deficiency from those that are not. So let me start with you, Ken. What are the other imaging modalities that are available or in development now?
Well, in Parkinson's disease, we're very fortunate. And we have, because we have developed a PET, and we're going to speak today about SPECT imaging to help us assist in the diagnosis. But there are a number of other imaging modalities which are under development. Most of these are in research setting. Certainly, MRI, particularly diffusion tensor imaging, has now emerged as a potential tool for diagnosis. Other PET modalities, and as well even MRI spectroscopy or Nigral ultrasound, all used in research setting.
Great, thank you. So let's go back to dopamine transporter imaging. Can you give us some background on this technique?
So dopamine transporter imaging is a very useful technique that has developed over the past decade or so in Parkinson's disease. Yeah, it relies on nuclear medicine technology and involves imaging the dopamine transporter, which is simply a protein which is on the dopamine nerve terminal. That protein is labeled with a radioisotope. It's injected into the individual through an IV injection, travels into the brain, and specifically and selectively tags those dopamine neurons and enables us to get a sense as to the amount of dopamine activity that's in the brain.
Great, thank you. Andy, what's the role of dopamine transporter imaging in clinical practice?
I think there are really two situations and two criteria that have to be met in thinking about ordering this type of imaging in clinical practice. I think there has to be some level of clinical uncertainty about the diagnosis, and I think there has to be some ability to feel that the result of the test will help you make a decision about therapy for patients.
Great, thank you. So one of the things under consideration is Parkinson's disease. Why don't we start there, Andy? What does a classic case of Parkinson's disease look like?
So Parkinson's disease, on average, starts at around the age of 60, although that can be very variable. And there are what we call four cardinal clinical signs of Parkinson's disease: rest tremor, bradykinesia, or slowness of movement, rigidity in the muscles or stiffness in the muscles, and problems with gait and balance. Not everybody with Parkinson's disease gets all four of those things, and it's possible for one person to have rest tremor and another not. And in fact, probably about 25 to 30% of patients with Parkinson's disease never have tremor of any kind. The disease typically starts asymmetrically and remains asymmetric throughout the course of the disease.
And what about classic response to the treatment?
So, of course, Parkinson's disease is caused by loss of primarily caused by loss of dopaminergic function in the brain, and replacing dopamine in the brain improves symptoms, often and usually dramatically.
Right. So what are the kinds of disorders that we're trying to distinguish Parkinson's disease from in the clinic?
Well, there really are several situations. One situation that comes up in practice, I think, are other common causes of tremor. So probably the two most common causes of tremor are Parkinson's disease and essential tremor. These are very different diseases. So Parkinson's disease, as I mentioned earlier, causes a rest tremor. It's usually asymmetric. Although there are times in some situations where people can have what looks like a postural or action component to their tremor. But typically it's a rest tremor, as opposed to essential tremor, which is typically a postural and action tremor that goes away with rest, is usually symmetric, and is not associated with the other Parkinsonian features we were talking about.
So you don't really see slowness or stiffness with essential
exactly.
tremor in classic cases. What about the category called atypical Parkinsonism? What are those disorders and what do they look like?
So those are neurodegenerative disorders, similar to Parkinson's disease in that sense, have different pathology, that do cause loss of dopamine in the brain, just like Parkinson's disease. The typical disorders that we think about in this category are called multisystem atrophy, or MSA, progressive supranuclear palsy, or PSP, and another condition called cortical basal ganglionic degeneration, sometimes referred to as CBGD or CBD. These disorders, except for the last one, these MSA and PSP are typically more symmetric than Parkinson's disease. And I would say for most patients with Parkinsonism, distinguishing Parkinson's disease from atypical Parkinsonism, especially after a number of years have gone by and people have been exposed to levodopa, most patients we can tell clinically whether we're dealing with Parkinson's disease or an atypical form of Parkinsonism. That's not so true in early Parkinsonism, but it's important to note, I think, that these conditions, as I mentioned, are characterized by loss of dopamine in the brain as well. So dopamine transporter imaging in these conditions will not be helpful for distinguishing Parkinson's disease from atypical Parkinsonism.
Right. So one of the things you said there was in Parkinson's disease, we typically see a robust and sustained benefit dopamine medication. In these atypical Parkinsonisms, usually get little or no benefit, and that helps distinguish them over time, but they're difficult to distinguish early on.
Exactly, because in many cases early on, people have not been exposed to dopaminergic medications.
Right. And again, the role of dopamine transporter imaging in distinguishing Parkinson's disease from the atypical Parkinsonisms?
So dopamine transporter imaging will be abnormal in Parkinson's disease and atypical Parkinsonism and will not be useful. Will not be useful in distinguishing these disorders.
So let's just review for a minute. What kinds of disorders, or what are the disorders that have abnormal dopamine transporter imaging?
Any disorder that causes the loss of dopaminergic neurons in the brain. And so this would include, obviously, classical idiopathic Parkinson's disease and these other atypical Parkinsonian syndromes I mentioned, specifically multisystem atrophy, progressive supranuclear palsy, and cortical basal ganglionic degeneration.
Great. And if we look at the opposite, what are some conditions in which one would expect a normal dopamine transporter imaging?
So this would be patients in whom the dopaminergic system is intact. And so people with essential tremor, for example, people who might look Parkinsonian, actually, for example, because they're on neuroleptics or drugs that block dopamine. People who are on other drugs that might cause tremor or other Parkinsonian features, but don't affect the dopamine. The dopaminergic neuron would be expected to be normal on dopamine transporter imaging.
Right. So, Ken, can you help us there? Are there other conditions that we need to keep in mind as having normal dopamine transporter imaging?
Yeah, I might add individuals with psychogenic Parkinson's disease is another small but important group. And perhaps even a greater, more sizable group are sort of older people who might have early dementia but have some extrapyramidal changes with Alzheimer's disease would be another group that would be expected to have normal dopamine transporter imaging and can be distinguished with dopamine transporter imaging.
And I would assume cases of multi-infarct syndromes such as multi-infarct Parkinsonism as well?
Yeah, that's, I think, another important category that could also be by and large distinguished from Parkinsonisms.
Yeah. Right. So, Andy, how do you decide which patients to refer for dopamine transporter imaging?
So as I mentioned earlier, there has to be uncertainty about the clinical diagnosis and a specific kind of uncertainty. I thought that it would be helpful to talk about, I thought of three specific kinds of examples of patients, not specific patients, but broad examples of situations in which I have found this kind of imaging to be helpful. One situation is the person who has a tremor, and perhaps both at rest and with action. Perhaps they've come to see you after seeing another neurologist and haven't had a response to typical treatment for essential tremor like a beta blocker or mycelline. And you don't want to commit them yet to a trial of a dopaminergic therapy. Sometimes treating tremor and Parkinson's disease, if you really want to treat the tremor, requires big doses of these medications to start to get the tremor under control. You're not ready to really commit someone to an aggressive course of therapy with a dopaminergic medication without being certain that you're dealing with Parkinson's disease. In that situation, I think dopamine transporter imaging could be helpful. Another situation that I think Ken referred to that I find it to be useful is often in older patients, but it could be a younger patient with multiple medical problems, perhaps generalized osteoarthritis that has slowed them down, some cervical cord disease that might have caused some gait problems, or diabetic neuropathy that is contributing to slowness and difficulty with coordination. Sometimes these people are on a lot of medications. You don't want to commit to starting them on a dopaminergic medication. They may have a tendency to developing complications of dopaminergic medications, such as hallucinations. So you don't want to commit them to this kind of a therapy until you're sure that they're, or fairly sure that they may benefit from it. And so in that situation, getting a dopamine transporter image, if it's abnormal, suggests that in addition to all these other medical problems, these people may have some Parkinson's disease under this and may benefit from dopaminergic therapy. And so it could really alter the course of your treatment. And then the third situation that I do think comes up, very frequently, but does come up, is people treated with medications, be it neuroleptics or other medications that that have made them potentially, an example of a situation would be a chronic psychiatric patient who is on a neuroleptic and been doing well, stable on a neuroleptic for many years, suddenly starts to show signs of Parkinsonism, and you're wondering, well, is this just chronic exposure to neuroleptics, or are we dealing with the beginnings of Parkinson's disease? It's important for making a decision about how to treat such a patient. And so dopamine transporter imaging would be helpful in that situation.
Great, thank you. So Ken, I think Andy mentioned a number of situations where the diagnosis clinically is difficult. What do studies tell us about how accurate clinicians are in their diagnoses of Parkinsonian and suspected Parkinsonian syndromes?
Well, there have been a number of studies that have addressed the issue of how accurate are physicians in diagnosing Parkinson's disease. Of course, the accuracy depends a bit on what category the physicians are in. But I mean by that is that general practitioners generally have less experience in diagnosing Parkinson's disease, and they may be less successful than general neurologists, who may in turn be less successful than movement disorder neurologists. Having said that, there are a number of studies in which, again, early, often more difficult cases are brought forward. And I think in those situations, the general practitioners may be incorrect in as high as 30 to 50% of the cases. The general neurologists may be 20 to 30%, the movement disorders 15 to 20%. So I think there is a large number of individuals in this small category of very more difficult, uncertain individuals that are difficult to diagnose, and long-term diagnosis shows that the initial diagnosis may be incorrect. I think in those situations, dopamine transporter imaging may be of value. I would emphasize, however, that in the majority of cases, the typical cases, it is possible to be pretty accurate in making a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease.
Great. So with regard to dopamine transporter imaging, how reliable is it?
Well, I think dopamine transporter imaging is very reliable, and that has been shown in a number of ways. Certainly, a simple way is to do test-retest reliability, showing that you'll get the same answer if you examine individuals one day and then a week later or 2 weeks later. I think where problems can arise is that, of course, the tests are read by nuclear medicine physicians, some of whom themselves may not be that experienced in reading these tests. So there can sometimes be uncertainty, again, in a small percentage of cases. I think that another important issue is that it's possible that certain drugs people are taking may modify the dopamine transporter results. In particular, the drugs that are in question are drugs like that may affect the dopamine transporter. Drugs like methylphenidate or Ritalin, amphetamines, some antidepressants that modify the dopamine transporter, like bupropion, and to some extent some other serotonin reuptake inhibitors as well. Though generally speaking, those don't need to be withdrawn before initiating a scan.
And what about dopamine therapies like levodopa or dopamine agonists?
Certainly, yeah. Certainly, individuals may well be on treatment when they are imaged. And I would say that the majority of data suggests that neither levodopa nor dopamine agonists significantly alter the dopamine transporter density scan, so that it's unlikely that they'll really have a big impact, and again, would not need to be withdrawn before initiating the scan.
So just leave them on those medications.
Yes.
And what about trying to use dopamine transporter imaging to monitor disease progression?
Well, certainly Parkinson's disease is a progressive illness, and we are very much in need of a tool to monitor disease progression. But while dopamine transporter imaging is very good at distinguishing Parkinson's disease from syndromes where there is no dopamine transporter deficit, like essential tremor, because by the time you've got symptoms of Parkinsonism, you've lost about 50%, say maybe 60%, of dopamine transporter activity, the change from year to year is much less, maybe 4 to 5%. So it's very difficult to use dopamine transporter imaging as a tool in a patient to guide them and you with regard to their progression of illness.
Great, thank you. And what about the situation if someone has an abnormal dopamine transporter SPECT scan but doesn't have any of the motor signs of Parkinsonism?
So this is really a very interesting question. I think it leads us to, a potential use of dopamine transporter imaging for the future. Certainly, as we, I think, have already discussed, Parkinson's disease is a progressive illness, and the dopamine deficit is evident way in advance of when motor symptoms begin. So there may be a period of 5 years, 10 years. We don't really know when you can see dopamine degeneration before symptoms arise. Now, that's discernible using dopamine transporter imaging. So we can look to a time when we can identify individuals by their dopamine transporter imaging even before symptoms arise, and then hopefully we will have medications that might prevent or slow the onset of disease. This would really something for the future, but something very exciting for us to look forward to.
And some of the research I know you're doing is to try and identify patients who might be appropriate to undergo dopamine transporter imaging, even in the absence of motor signs. What are the kinds of things that you're seeing that might tip us off in that regard?
Right, so that one of the challenges is to identify who might be these people who are destined to develop Parkinson's disease before they have symptoms. And I think research that we've done, but many, many have done over the last decade, has identified a number of early symptoms that may tip us off that these people are going to develop Parkinson's disease. One is a loss of smell. Another is a sleep disorder called REM behavior disorder. A third, of course, may be a genetic predisposition. As we've learned more about the genetics of Parkinson's disease, there are groups that clearly have a genetic risk that can be identified and may also be a group that could be imaged and followed prior to the onset of disease.
You mentioned REM behavior disorder. Just very briefly, what is REM behavior disorder?
REM behavior disorder is a very unusual sleep disorder in which individuals may actually have a number of abnormal movements in sleep, may sort of act out their dreams. They're very active. They may jump out of bed. They may smack one of their partners. And this is a disorder really that can only accurately diagnosed by polysomnography, but it turns out that this is a disorder that confers a substantial risk to develop Parkinsonism sometime in the future.
Andy, how do you discuss the results of dopamine transporter SPECT imaging with patients?
I think it depends on the individual patient's clinical situation and on the results of the scan. If it's somebody who has the kind of situation I was talking about earlier with a mixed type of tremor and we're not sure if we're dealing with essential tremor or Parkinson's disease, if the scan is clearly abnormal, I would tell the person that they likely have Parkinson's disease, and if I had the opportunity, I would show the scan to them and explain to them what we expect to see and what we're seeing on their scan. And I think people get something out of that, actually seeing the scan. I think if it's somebody who looks Parkinsonian and has a normal SPECT scan, that's often a more difficult situation because you may be dealing with a conversion type of disorder or functional disorder, and that has to be handled a little bit more delicately. But I would try to give it a positive spin and say to the patient that it looks like you do not have Parkinson's disease and you do not have a neurodegenerative disease. Of course, that could happen in other situations, for example, neuroleptic exposure and that type of thing. So it really depends on the exact situation. But I do like to try, if I can, if I have access to the scan itself, show it to the patients and explain it to them, what I'm seeing.
Excellent. And Ken, let me ask you, if a patient has a normal dopamine transporter imaging result, when you discuss it with the patient, do you leave the door open for the possibility of them still either having or getting Parkinson's disease, or you really just say, no, you don't have that?
I think that how you discuss this, as Andy indicated, depends a bit upon what the clinical setting is. But I think it's important to remember that Parkinson's disease is a clinical diagnosis. The scan is there to assist us. And a normal scan, I think, certainly points us in a direction other than Parkinson's disease. But I think we need to all gather additional experience and insight. I would present it as good news for the patient. I would present it as it's unlikely that this is Parkinson's disease. But I think the door still needs to be left open.
And Ken, you brought examples of normal and abnormal dopamine transporter SPECT imaging today. Can you tell us what you see on those scans?
Yes, and I think that what one would expect to see in those individuals with early Parkinson's disease really reflects what you would expect to see from the pathology of Parkinson's disease. So what you see is an asymmetric loss of activity, which is greater in the area of the brain called the putamen than the caudate. And I think that it's important that even in individuals that may have only one side affected with regard to their clinical symptoms, typically manifest some abnormalities on their scan bilaterally. So just to go back to a moment to what Andy was talking about, showing the patient the scan, this is an issue that frequently arises, that an individual may look at the scan and only then realize that this is a bilateral disease. So that's something I think to be prepared for as you're discussing this with the patient and prepare the patient for as well.
Excellent, thank you. So Andy, take-home messages for our audience today?
I would say, from my perspective, the most important thing about making a clinical decision about whether to order a dopamine transporter SPECT scan is that there has to be uncertainty about whether the person truly has Parkinsonism versus something else. And also, I do think it is important that there has to be a consequence to the scan, that there has to be some effect. You have to anticipate there will be some effect of the result of the scan on determining clinical decision making.
Great. Ken?
Well, I would agree that I think it's important to keep in mind that the scans are not for every patient with Parkinson's disease. In fact, most patients can be managed clinically. But I think what we have now is a new tool, which is very useful, which can really help us to make diagnoses earlier, and I think really takes us into a future where we may even be able to identify individuals prior to when symptoms begin. And I think that's something very exciting.
That really sounds like the future. And I agree what you all have said. I think this is a new tool to help aid in our clinical diagnoses. I think if I'm just to relay one point, I think it's for folks to remember that abnormal dopamine transporter SPECT scans indicate a loss of dopamine terminals or dopamine neurons, and that occurs in Parkinson's disease as well as other atypical Parkinsonian syndromes. So it's not just abnormal scan equals Parkinson's disease. There's still a lot of differential diagnosis work that needs to be done. Similarly, a normal scan isn't just essential tremor. We said it occurs in healthy people. People may have psychogenic symptoms. People may have a whole range of other disorders like multi-infarct state, medication-induced neurologic problems that have effects where the dopamine system is still normal. I want to thank my colleagues for joining me today and you for your interest in broadening your understanding of the role of dopamine transporter imaging in patients with suspected Parkinsonian disorders. To access the CME post-test and evaluation, just click on the Earn CME Credit button below.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Parkinsonian Syndromes, Improving Diagnostic Sensitivity and Specificity with Dopamine Transporter Imaging. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.